Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Aquarium. I'm Jerry Schubel, and it's great to see all of you here this evening. I'd like to ask you all to silence your cell phones or put them on vibrate for the rest of the evening. I want to thank our lecture sponsor, Gazette Newspapers, that makes this series possible. Tonight, I'm very pleased to welcome Max Coleman. He's going to discuss his search for life on other planets using ways of detecting microbial life from Earth's ancient ecosystems, hydrothermal vents primarily. Max Coleman is the director of the Center for Life Detection and the leader of the Astrobiology Research Group at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech in Pasadena. He grew up in London and was always a very curious youngster, got very interested in science. It wasn't because of prodding by mentors or parents or even going to an aquarium. He was just naturally curious, and that has continued throughout his life. He studied chemistry, geology, isotope geochemistry at both London and Leeds universities in the UK, and after 10 years of working for the British Geological Survey, where he ran an isotope analysis facility, he joined BP. Now, some of you are wondering, and I was just talking to Max, you know, we often forget how much important science oil companies have done and how much they've contributed to our knowledge of the geology of the seafloor and the substructure, the geophysics of the ocean. He was at BP and he started a geochemical research group. He then moved to the University of Reading in 1995 as a professor of sedimentology. He joined the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab at Caltech in 2003 as the director of the Center for Life Detection and as leader of the Astrobiology Research Group. In 2009 and part of 2012, he spent sabbatical periods in Paris where he worked on aspects of the capture and storage of CO2, something that's going to become increasingly important. And that was related, of course, to climate change research. He then returned to JPL, and he began to focus again on looking for life outside of the Earth by developing approaches that used minerals as a signature of life, and he also developed the instruments to detect those. He has worked with the Schmidt Ocean Institute and their ship, the Falkor, and some of you know that Wendy Schmidt was part of a forum that we did here in July of 23. So Max, in his work with the Schmidt Ocean Institute, went to some deep hydrothermal vents looking for clues of life there that could be clues to life on the moon of Jupiter, Europa. And Max is going to tell us about this life of exploration and discovery. Please join me in welcoming Max Coleman.
Jerry, am I live, by the way?
You're
live. Jerry, thanks very much for that lovely introduction. Now, before I get going, this, for those of you who remember a long time ago, with audiovisual stuff, it was always lantern slides. Jerry will remember that. Then we moved on a bit, and then there were acetate sheets, which curled up. Or 35mm slides, which dropped out of the cassette. I'm going to go back to a time before PowerPoint, so I'm going to use PowerPoint, a time when people actually showed you things happening. And this is based on my work with the Royal Institution in London, where people demonstrate how things work. So that's part of it. But there's also the audience participation. Now, you see, I've set out here a rather bizarre array of my meal here. Cup with some water, a candle, some mustard, by the way. Thank you, Jerry. A bread roll and some phosphorus. Now, what I want you as an audience to do is, if I'm distracted and getting on telling you things, if the candle lights itself or the bread roll eats itself or the phosphorus bursts into flames, please let me know, because that's going to be quite important. Okay, looking for life on Earth and in the oceans and in space. I'm going to tell you, I am an astrobiologist. My job is looking for life outside the Earth. So where do I look? I look at Mars. That's a good possibility. Further from the Earth, further from the Sun than the Earth, and Europa. These are not the only ones, but they're ones that focus my attention. Now, that's a long way away from the Sun. Earth is 93 million, Mars is further away and colder, but both have evidence of the presence of water. In the case of Mars, relatively little now, but maybe quite a lot in the past. So, in terms of looking for life with space missions, how much have we got for life detection missions on Europa? And they're all listed there. Zilch. So, that doesn't mean we've not been looking at Europa. There have been a number of missions. There have been, for example, Voyager, that marvellous twin spacecraft, now outside the solar system in 1977, went past in 1979. Galileo, massive great spacecraft, on and on and on, until we get to, today, Europa Clipper, that's 2021. We don't think it'll be that soon, but we have a major study, which I'm part of at the moment, a $2 billion, maybe $3 billion mission, flagship mission, 3 to 5 years, electric propulsion, solar electric. It's going to be a marvelous thing if we can do it. So there's lots in the works, but nothing actually happened yet. Now, we look at Mars, and Mars actually is a much better thing. We had, in the days when there was no expense spared, Viking 1, Viking 2, but this actually lets us enter the secret about the way NASA operates and space exploration operates. We had planned a 2009 launch led by a European Space Agency with NASA help. Unfortunately, that was delayed to 2011. 2011, unfortunately, that was delayed somewhat. So we then had the 2013 launch of ExoMars, the life exploration of Mars. And yes, you guessed it. So they thought, this isn't good enough. It's too expensive. We're going to make it somewhat better. What we're going to do is make 3 smaller missions. Oh, that's good. One led by Europeans, one led by NASA, and the third one, who knows. Yeah, that was replanned because it wasn't really going to work. So they decided they would have a NASA, ESA, launch 2018, MAX-C, is not Max Coleman, it's Max, caching samples, going to be taking samples, which at some time in the future would be brought back. And then NASA said, no, we can't work like this. So NASA is doing, and this is a real mission, a 2020 launch, Mars 2020 it's called, very imaginatively, and sometime in the distant future, 2020 something, 2030 something, maybe we'll get samples back to Earth. We don't need to, we can do a lot in situ, but we do want samples back to Earth. So what I'm trying to make the point here is everything keeps changing and can keep on changing. We never know where we are. So we have then Mars 2011, the fact that this previous one was going to be cut down in an impossible way. What are we going to do? And then the ESA mission, they're working with the Russians now. Well, I hope it works. But the real problem is, these changes, what happens? Is it a threat or an opportunity? Well, I'm an optimist. I would say this is an opportunity. But what do we actually do without any space missions? So what we do is, we develop new scientific approaches, new biosignatures. Well, a biosignature, I'm going to talk about those later, is a sign of life. And then we test these approaches on Earth. And you must be saying, on Earth, but why in the oceans? And I'm going to talk about that. And I'm also going to talk about why I, as an astrobiologist, have managed to persuade NASA to let me do oceanography. So, before I go further, I've got to give you a helpful. This is serious. I am a scientist. I'm meant to be rational and logical and, say, unbiased. But I'm looking for life. What do we know about life? This is a very unobjective, very biased view because we only have one example of life. I'm going to come back to that later, how similar all life is on Earth. And therefore, we have a problem. if it's not like life on Earth, how will we know what it is? So we have to have a possibility of trying to understand not only developing these things, but what sort of life are we going to look for? So that's what I'm going to talk about as well. So these are the three parts. How we talk, what is life and what are we going to look for if it's not like life on Earth? Though we, if it is like life on Earth, that'd be easier. And then new scientific approaches there, and then looking the fun bit, going out on expeditions and doing things. So we start with that first one, what life to search for. And we're going to work on some things which are Earth-like, and that is the fact that we need energy and water for life. And the reason for that is simple. Life basically does a lot of chemistry as far as we're concerned, and to have energy and water allows these things to go on. And I'm going to talk about chemical potential energy, but don't get worried. I will try not to lose you as I talk this very high science. Well, not that high. That may be available, but what about water? Now, I'd like to take you on a trip outside the Earth and look at water on Mars, sedimentary deposits. That's the MER rover, 2004. Water lane deposits, that's good. Europa, a shell of water ice, and it's important to say water ice, because there are other ices like carbon dioxide ice, covering that surface. But that's all for Mars. Actually, Europa's much, much more fun. So we'll talk about Europa. But are we? I hope you will be in an aquarium. It's not waterless. It's just got an icy top, but you'll see what it's like. What I'd like to do is say a little bit about the history of life on Earth, which will lead us into what sort of life we look for. These two ingredients, energy and water, both may have been available very early on Earth. And there's some lovely artistic impressions, beautiful stuff done by Don Dixon for some research that was going on in Wisconsin, about what, at that time, people had thought the early Earth was like. Very chaotic. No place for life to really come along. No bodies of water on the surface. The whole planet was mixed up. And then this work by my colleague John Valley, looking at very, very old minerals, decided that in fact it was possible. There had been surface water. Now we have this much more beautiful scene here, more like we know the Earth today. And as long ago as maybe only 0.15 billion years after the Earth was formed. That's all very well. Let's have a look and see what these things actually look like. The oldest confirmed stuff that we know about are these materials called stromatolites. They're domed sediments, and they're domed because the organisms, the bacteria that live in them, want to continually get up towards the light. These are 2,700 million years old. We have older stuff. Abby Allwood, former postdoc of mine, now working at JPL again, is we've been looking at stuff which is 3.5 billion years old, when, remember, the Earth is 4.55 billion. So these, although they're a bit messed up, metamorphosed, they are bacterial sediments. Bacteria is a form of life, and there are sediments nearby which have bacterial mats in them. So we have real evidence, but down to 3.5 billion years old. Now, this is slightly embarrassing. As I said, I'm an astrobiologist, and there is, of course, as many of you may know, the ancient order of astrobiologists. And when you are inducted as an astrobiologist, you have to, I can't go into the whole ceremony because some of it's secret, but you have to swear certain oaths. One of which is to give an obligatory feeble analogy for every talk you give. Like, for example, if the Earth is the size of an orange and the moon is the size of an apple and a dams and a goodness knows what. So what I'm going to do, my obligatory feeble analogy is to do the history of the Earth in one day, which may be useful. So I keep on spouting out 4.5 billion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Let's actually put this into context. A 24-hour day, what has happened in the history of the Earth up till now as a 24-hour day? So, we start off with the real age, 4,450 million, and we come down to now. This is still a lot of information to take in one go. So let's put in a landmark, lunchtime. So we have lunchtime there between 10:48 and 1:58. Having that helps us, so we can now look at different parts of the history, and we can say, okay, we started off at midnight, and by 3 a.m., we have the first life, microbial life. We go on. By 9 p.m., we have multicellular life. So from 3 a.m. to 9 p.m., it's been microbes all the way. And then finally, from 9 p.m., we get organisms which produce fossils. And then very, very, very nearly at midnight, we get humans, or just pre-humans. The story from that is very simple. The story is, if you're going to be looking for life, look at this. For that great big green bit, the majority of Earth's history, it has been microbial life, and nothing more. And therefore, we have to look for microbial life. So, what life to look for? Microbial, yes. But what if it's not like life on Earth? Can we have something more generic? So I thought about this when I first went to JPL. How do we define life? What are the characteristics of life? And not being a real biologist, I went back to my high school biology and decided on what are the things that make living organisms living organisms. And there are a number of characteristics here. They are organized into a shape. Let me just try an experiment. He blinked. Response to stimulus is built in. It may not be shutting your eye. It may be response to a pheromone. It may be following a chemical signal. Metabolize. Now, if I were from another galaxy coming here to see if there's life on Earth, and I've got infrared vision, I would see you all breathing out carbon dioxide. So you were metabolizing. I'd be able to see that. That's a good one. Growth. That's a bit harder with me as the alien researcher, because I'd have to be here for a time, or maybe have known you for a considerable period of time to see if you've grown. Reproduction. No, none happening at the moment, so that's okay. So, showing heredity is again a thing you need a lot of time. Similarly with adaptation and evolution as signs of life, characteristics of life, they're very difficult to work if you're landing in a spaceship and want to see what's going on, and you don't know if you recognize a fossil or not. So the value of these is mainly the ones that I spoke about there, being organized, maybe response to stimulus if it's chemical, and metabolism. If you're only there for a short time, these are still possibilities, and some are definitely no-nos. If you want to think those which are useful, we're coming down then really to a very limited selection. Organized and metabolize. So, that's fine, but if life had happened, and this may be the case on Mars, and has now disappeared, what will we see? And that is not as good, except maybe if it's left fossils, but we can't be sure we would find them. So we're coming down now to two characteristics that we really want to focus on. Is it an organized a shape that we could recognize as possibly being not natural, but being lifelike? That's natural, sorry. And metabolism. Okay. I've got a working definition of life. A self-organized system capable of processing energy so that it can take advantage of that energy, and then we can consider that a very simple, minimalistic definition of life. I'm not going to do the thermodynamic bit of that because I would lose myself as well as losing you. And I'm going to focus here on chemical energy because it's more easily measurable. There is another aspect of this, which the energy needs to be accessed faster than a non-biological system could do so. And I'm going to show you that by means of a demonstration now. You have, I hope, been keeping your eyes on these things here. And has the candle set itself alight? No. Has the bedroll eaten itself? No. Why? are they good energy sources? They are good energy sources. Now, in the case of the candle, it's got chemical energy stored there, which we can release, and I hope the fire system here is not that good. We will see if the smoke detector... Ah, that's good. So I'm releasing that potential energy in the form of heat, a little bit of light. Similarly, the energy stored in this, in the form of carbohydrate, which I'll come back to in just a moment, can be released or burnt, you want to say, if you're burning carbs, in exactly the same way as that, but not at a high temperature, so excuse me speaking with my mouth full, but by enzymes in my body releasing the energy stored in here. If we had to live, instead of carbohydrate or hydrocarbon, had to live with white phosphorus as our source of energy, there may be a problem. Now let me, I hope, there's no one in the front row, so we're okay. Oh, sorry, it has self-combusted, as white phosphorus will do, and therefore, if we had to rely on white phosphorus as our source of energy, we wouldn't be alive. We'd be effectively snuffed out, because natural processes would consume the energy from that faster than we could take advantage of it. And that's a pretty general rule for most bacterial systems. The bacteria that survive best in most odd situations are those that take advantage of being able to release the energy from chemicals, which the natural system cannot do in the same way. So, what do we actually look for? Signs of life, biosignatures. The typical ones are bits of very complicated molecules expanded up there. We see these on some of the planetary materials and meteorites, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. The ones we see there are not life signs, but the ones we get on Earth are. And amino acids. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. And we all are made of protein. I want to go into that a little bit further because it's actually quite interesting. You can imagine amino acids, many of them, but not all of them, are not identical. They can either be one of two forms, left-handed or right-handed. They're mirror images of each other, and they can't be totally superimposed. And the thing about life on Earth, it all seems to have descended from a common ancestor which had left-handed amino acids. So, what we have there is the fact that we can detect whether they're all left-handed, but there are other amino acids. We found amino acids in meteorites. These are not biological, and we know they're not because there is an equal amount of left and right-handedness. One amino acid, glycine, is found actually in space. And interestingly, there are more than 70 amino acids in meteorites, but life only uses 23 of them. Higher life uses 23. More primitive life only uses 21. But we share 21 common amino acids. We have one sort of life which we can look at on Earth. And I just want to make that point again. Okay, looking at structures. Structures, the stromatolites I mentioned before, which can either be seen in cross-section as a dome or on top as a series of sources, inverted sources. That's a structure. Bacterial cells, that's a jolly good structure. You can see that those are life, and they're not, they don't look like minerals or anything else. So those are our definitions which we can use to look for life. So let me move on now. What I've tried to do is say we've got a way of deciding what life to look for, and it's going to be microbial. We've got ways of looking at it, even if it's not like microbes on Earth, because it'll be doing funny chemistry. It'll be doing chemistry faster than the natural system would normally expect. So the other thing we do is develop new scientific approaches, new biosignatures. My particular interest, one of my interests, is mineral biosignatures. Now, mineral, you know, is heavy, rocky, hard material. But I've come to the amazing conclusion that breath, as a metabolite, is a biosignature. But it's not part of the atmosphere, not like oxygen breathed out like plant by plants. It is actually the exhaled breath of organisms could be a good mineral biosignature. Do I detect a little bit of incredulity in the audience that breath could be a mineral? Well, if you are unconvinced, I'm going to try and convince you now with a practical demonstration of turning breath into a mineral biosignature. Now, I'm sorry for people who have only done maybe master's level in chemistry, but here we have carbon dioxide and lime water, calcium hydroxide solution, precipitates calcium carbonate, which is limestone. So that's a chemical equation. For those of you who've now done probably a PhD or more in chemistry, I'll put it the right way up in the way you would expect it. A horizontal chemical equation, carbon dioxide plus lime water, limestone, gives limestone. Let me do this. I hope. Practical demonstrations are always very, very dangerous. The danger here being that it may not work, and I will finish up very embarrassed, but if it does happen, I will immediately put on a video of the same thing. Could you have a look at this? Can you see through that solution in the bottom? Is it clear? I'll go for a less reliable witness, but I'll go... It's clear. Now, what I'm going to do, you'll have to talk amongst yourselves while I do it, because I don't have any background music. Below in here. Is it still clear?
No.
I don't know if all of you can see this, but it has definitely started going cloudy.
Pull us alive.
Is there a doctor in the house? I've got cloud is alive. So I've precipitated limestone from my breath. But this isn't science until you can do something a little bit more quantitative about it. I'm just going to skip over the next slide, if I can do it quickly enough. That's with my insurance policy. How much limestone? We've got to quantify it. To make it science, we need to quantify it. So I can make simple, conservative estimates, the sort of numbers you can get by Googling these facts, for example, breath volume of oxygen in that air is 4/10, 4/5 nitrogen, 1/5 oxygen. Maximum volume of carbon dioxide we would get, assume that my lungs used to be 20% efficient, probably not now. So we can get that. We can then go, how many breaths per minute? 15, if I'm not breathing hard, okay. Volume minimum, volumes per minute of CO2, volumes per day of carbon dioxide, moles per day. For the chemist, don't worry if you don't understand. I'm going to come to a number you'll understand any moment now. The amount of limestone I would produce in a year is 700 kilos, 3/4 of a ton. Would anyone have, if I'd asked you, have guessed that much? Yes, you probably would, actually. So, which is why I didn't ask you. I think the important thing is that is a very robust biosignature. 9 times my body mass of limestone per year. That's a really good monument to leave if you want someone to find if you've been alive or not. But how is it a biosignature? This limestone is in fact different from other limestones. It differs because they're not formed in the same way. Mostly. Most limestones are formed from the shells of small organisms, marine organisms. They're formed from carbon dioxide in seawater forming carbonate, a mineral. So So how do we tell them apart? My breath, breathed out, or a bit of limestone from some completely other, different origin? And the answer is we can actually identify the source of the carbon that went into it. I'm sorry, I have put up another chemical equation. This is carbohydrate, carbon, water, plus oxygen gives carbon dioxide and water. And the important thing is that carbohydrate has carbon, which goes into carbon dioxide in my breath, which goes to form the limestone. And the answer is stable isotopes tell us about this. Now, don't get frightened about isotopes. We're not talking about radioactivity. We're talking about chemical elements which are subtly different from each other. Not all the carbon that we have is the same. Chemically, it behaves exactly the same. Some are heavier than others. More neutrons in the atomic nucleus. Isotopes are stable, they're non-radioactive, and for example, with carbon, 99% of all carbon is carbon-12. The minority is carbon-13. And this just happens to be my good friend Charles Curtis, who was in Canada, luckily, after they went metric and found carbon-13, which saves a great embarrassment, because carbon-8.5 would defy a lot of physical laws, I think. So, moving on. Carbon isotope characteristics, I want to rush through a bit more. There's normal carbon, and there's organic matter, which has less carbon. And therefore, if we have a metabolic product, carbon dioxide, produced like that, it is a very good thing. I breathe air. There are microbes which don't breathe air. They breathe all sorts of other things. They breathe chemical called sulfate, which contains oxygen, which is found in seawater everywhere. They use the oxygen in rust. And then there's some which produce bugs, which produce, they all produce distinctive mineral and isotopic signatures. Now, that is a biosignature and a half. That is all produced by microbial metabolism efficiently being precipitated in marine water. This is another one. Now, I just want you to get a sense of how durable and robust biosignatures can be. This is one of those which should be cut in half. And I'd like to just pass them around. If you can move them around, don't drop them on the floor. You'll probably cause damage, which Jerry will sue you for. But this is a very durable biosignature. So, we've got those. There's another form which you may see, it's going back to being rusty again, but this was an iron carbonate. Notice we're going back now 320 million years, knowing what sort of bacteria were there, what they were doing, the whole work. What we have then is to think about, we've got minerals. Minerals can be formed by other processes. So we've got a good chance of finding minerals, but we've got to do this subtle interpretation to find out exactly whether they're biological or not. And what we would really like is to work on things which are organic and living, but are unlikely to be preserved in many environments, particularly on the surface of Mars. But there are other places to look. And that's why we want to look on life in the oceans and answer why I am doing oceanography. And for Europa, where there is a possibility of extant life now, if not past life, it will be in the ocean. But Europa is very different from Earth in some respects. It's tiny, it's not a planet, it's a moon. It's rocky. It's very, very, very cold, as you can see there. A lot of radiation from the sun being focused by Jupiter. Surface covered by ice. 6 miles to 18 miles thick, depending on who you believe, and a salty ocean which may be as deep as 60 miles. I mean, this is some ocean on a very small planetary body. But best of all, it is very Earth-like. It has, we think, a metallic core. It has a rocky outside, and it has this ocean and then the ice shell on the outside of that. So it is potentially a good analogue for Earth. And as you will see, we thought a lot to find a terrestrial analogue which we could go and explore. And we just about managed, and it just happens to be south of Grand Cayman, and NASA just happened to agree to pay for us to go there and look. And what we went looking for in 2009, in this area, there, there's Gulf of Florida, Cuba's over there somewhere, were the most amazing things. We discovered, when we were looking for the deepest hydrothermal vent on Earth, three new hydrothermal vent sites, including one which is the Black Smoker, which I'll show you a bit of later. We named them Picard, for Jacques Picard, who together with Don Walsh, which we named the second of them, the guys who went down to the deepest part of Earth's ocean, 1959 or 60, in a bathyscaphe, completely loony, very brave. I've met Don Walsh since, he's such a lovely man. And, of course, the third one we had to call Europa. Then, a little bit later, the UK team went around and found another one right near our Europa called Von Damm. In fact, Von Damm is a really much nicer example than Europa, and we've looked extensively at Von Damm and Picard. Picard is the deepest hydrothermal vent set on Earth at 3 miles down. Von Damm is only 2.3 kilometres, mile and a half-ish, much less, but still deep. The important thing is, we're at the deepest part of the ocean. Is there life there? Well, if you've been around the museum here, you know that there actually is. So let me quickly go through the number of different places we had to go to get money, expeditions to go there, go back there, paid for by NASA on the Cape Hatteras, paid for by NOAA, which was an interesting expedition because telepresence. I didn't go on that. I sat in my office with three live video streams of what they were seeing under the water. Back again with money from NSF in the Atlantis. And then most recent physical one was with the Schmidt Ocean Institute on the Falkor, again with live HD streaming all the time we were there, and education and public outreach stuff going on all the time. Then we came back again a little bit later with Bob Ballard's Nautilus. Again, I wasn't on it, but was able to interact with it. So, we have in, I hope, yes. Many of you have been on Research Festival. Some of you have not. I really want to tell you what it is actually like when you're not doing the science as well as when you are. This is an important part there, but I'll come back to that. The Atlantis is a big research vessel. You get a lot of scientists on board, you have a lot of crew, but the most important thing is the galley and the cook, right? And it's like a floating diner. Sorry, it's half a floating diner and half a floating engineering factory. Get very well fed, and you need to. If you've just been leading a watch for 32 hours, you want to relax a little bit and have something to eat after. And of course, non-stop coffee, particularly if you're doing a 32-hour watch. Let's move on. The way we actually get things is by having a remotely operated underwater vehicle. This is a massive bit of equipment with two massive manipulators at the front. You see, this is what I'm saying. It's an engineering factory, and it really is. And that goes down and is controlled remotely from the ship. A lot of heavy engineering. The way this is working is we have the Atlantis or another vessel up there, but it bobs up and down in the waves. You don't want to jerk the remotely operated vehicle up and down, so you have something to absorb the shock in between, which is called, the intermediate thing is called Medea in this case, and that's Jason, the underwater vehicle. How do we actually work with Jason? Again, you may have seen results, but actually, where is it controlled? It's controlled basically from a large container, which is put onto the ship, but contains inside it everything that is needed. It's the mission control. Screen after screen after screen after screen grad student after grad student, postdoc after postdoc. But most importantly, right at the front, there are three men, one of whom is an engineer, another one who is actually driving the ship remotely, and the most important guy sits in the middle with two of these manipulators and three or four screens, usually three, doing what leader of the watch will ask him to do. Pick up that sample. Move along a bit here. It is a phenomenal bit of skillful, brilliant control to be able to do that. So, where were we? We were in the Mid-Cayman spreading centre, two tectonic plates emerging from there, one of them actually butting against the other a little bit. And we have phenomenal difference in height in terms of Picard being very deep. And, you know, 15 miles away, less than 15 miles away, 12 miles away, we have Von Damme on a volcanic mound. A great place to do experiments so we can actually look at the differences between places which are apparently very, very similar. We have very hot water, twice the boiling point at surface. We have all sorts of organisms. This is from the Okeanos Explorer video. And in some cases, lots and lots and lots of tube worms. These are unusual. These are seep-like rather than hydrothermal vent-like, but they're still tube worms. And then there are shrimp, and I'm going to come back to shrimp again and again and again. These are very interesting, and there's a lot of them. They are teeming. All around the area, there's very little happening. And there are these blind shrimp, lots of them. And the important thing is, they clearly are thriving, so there's a lot of nutrient for them. And then there's predators, like fish, also blind. And then we can sample them with this, basically, what is a large vacuum cleaner sucking up shrimp. So, we have various forms of life there. We have these, the ones I've shown you, sea star, and anemones, which are also very, very predatory. Okay. In contrast, Picard is very much more dramatic in terms of what's going on with the black smoke coming out from four chimneys there. Mineral chimneys formed by when this very, very hot water, 400 degrees Celsius, 770 Fahrenheit. Now, what I want to show you here, there are more than one sort of shrimp. That is the sort that we've seen before, of which there are many, but this one seems to be a lone one, and that's a pink shrimp, being followed by a blue shrimp, which is carnivorous. Oh, well, I assume it's carnivorous, rather than that being a pink lady shrimp, and that's a blue male shrimp, going for a bit of shrimp tail there, but you never know. Anyway, so we also get other things present. The sea anemones are present at both sites, and they are at the top of the food chain with the fish, because any shrimp that swims near there gets gobbled up. So the important thing is, how does this work? How does life work without cyanide? We depend on photosynthesis. These organisms do not. And I want to talk about that now, rather briefly. Here comes the chemistry again. You don't have to flinch, it's okay. Food equals carbohydrate. The bread roll, if I wanted to eat the candle, I suppose I could, it would not be so nutritious. Carbon and hydrate, water, hydrous water. Photosynthesis takes energy from the sun and combines the carbon dioxide and the water to give carbohydrate, and the plants do this on the surface of the earth, giving off oxygen. If we reverse that, we can release the energy, which is what I was trying to tell you about there. The carbohydrate plus oxygen can be burnt to give carbon dioxide, exactly the same as that the other way around. At the bottom of the ocean, apart from a small amount of stuff which has been grown on the surface by photosynthesis and filters down, and at depths, greater depths, there's almost none of that. And that's why we are so interested in comparing these two sites. Chemosynthesis is exactly the same sort of process, but it has a different energy source. There's sulfur coming out from that vent, and the bacteria can take that sulfur and the oxygen dissolved in the water and make carbohydrate. And that would work on Europa too, where there is potentially hydrothermal vents and oxygen dissolved in the water. So, what I've been doing and the way I was able to get this great fun of going out to sea was saying, if we get to know Europa a little bit better, how much life could there be there? In other words, if you have this certain amount of energy coming out from a hydrothermal vent, how much life could it support? And to understand that, we're looking at the Cayman vents in detail. And we're looking at the food chain, because if you produce the food, you can't count it twice if something else has eaten it. So we want to make sure we know what we're doing. Photosynthesis or chemosynthesis? And isotopically, there's a way of looking at this. I bring back the stable isotopes again. You are what you eat plus one per mil, where the per mil is a unit of measuring stable isotopes. It's just it's a thousandth. I mean, it's a very small amount of the isotope, carbon-13, being added. And that's a real, this was a quote first made in the 1970s. And similarly, there are ways of looking at nitrogen and sulfur, which also tell you what's going on. So we looked at Rimicaris. And we looked and we thought, how do these Rimicaris live? We know how they live. They actually have these chemosynthetic bacteria which they farm. They have specially adapted gill covers. They have the bacteria in these gill covers and they position themselves just in the right place so that the bacteria are happy and then the bacteria exude carbohydrate. The shrimp don't have to eat them and the shrimp can absorb the carbohydrate and other things produced by the bacteria. So that's a really good symbiotic relationship. Why then, when we looked at this range of values, why was it so large? It was all wrong. Chemosynthetic bacteria in one place, they should have exactly the same carbon isotope value. And then, after that disappointment, had another cruise. This was work done by a postdoc of mine, Sarah Bennett. Although they should have been the same, they weren't, and then had an idea. We went back and we found there were two sorts of shrimp, dense shrimp and sparse shrimp. Those that were teeming like you saw before, and others which are separated out very, very much, as opposed to those which are all focused all together. So this gave me an idea, and I was with Cindy Vandover on the Falkor. And she said, oh, I've found a microscope. She's a biologist, I'm not. She said, oh, I can do dissections under the microscope. I said, great. She said, I'll teach you. I said, oh, okay. And we dissected shrimp. And we looked at what was going on. And we looked at what was in their guts and what was their tails. And we could see here that the dense shrimp were chemosynthetic. But there's a massive range of stuff going on there. And the idea that we've come to is that these are not living off chemosynthetic bacteria, contrary to popular belief. And in fact, they're doing something completely different. So, what they are doing, we think, is either being cannibalistic, which they shouldn't be, or they're eating their own outer shells, which they discard at regular intervals. But that doesn't seem enough to go on with. I've got some other stuff here which I really want to rush through because of the time. We can actually look at the parts, the polyunsaturated fatty acids, the things that make up the cells that these organisms have, in the same way that we need fatty acids, like omega-3 fatty acids, some of which we can make and some of which we can't, some of which are produced by photosynthesis only, people said. We now don't believe that. That is just saying this is a very complicated molecule. Some are produced by chemosynthesis. This is another, different, very complicated molecule. If it's produced by photosynthesis, it should have one sort of isotopic composition. If it's produced by another sort of by chemosynthesis, it should be different. And what we have here is these particular fatty acids showing the deep ones from Picard and the shallower ones from Von Damme. And Photosynthetic should be numbers to the left. Chemosynthetic should be numbers to the right. They're not the same. Von Damme and Picard actually have different, same chemical composition, but different isotopes. And this one in particular appealed because they are dramatically different. This is meant to be produced only by photosynthesis, and we've now shown that they're producing it at depth by chemosynthesis. So we can say that Von Damme has some photosynthetic influence, stuff dripping down from above, as opposed to what's happening in Picard. Okay, let's move on. I think I've gone through and said what life to search for, microbial life, and life that really, if it's not like Earth-like, will still have a way of processing energy that we could recognize. We developed these new approaches, these mineral biosignatures, which would be useful on Mars, but not so much on Europa. But best of all, we've been able to get out into the oceans and look for life. Before I finish, which is very near now, I just want to show you Medea, the intermediate bit between Jason and the Atlantis in the boat. And you see here a neckcloth with it's got styrofoam cups in it. And this is a measure, a very funny measure, of pressure. If you take a styrofoam cup, as you probably know, it's made mainly of air and a little bit of styrofoam. If it goes down, as it will do, to 3 miles, the pressure is immense. And it comes back much smaller. And if you write on it to start with, it comes back with small writing on it. And, for example, you can take a cup, you can decorate it, and you can take it up to that sort of pressure. And this is great, because you can get a whole classroom of kids to initial or sign or design their own cups, and they come back, their own cup has come back shrunken. And what I'd like to do is give Dr. Schubel, Jerry. This one started off like this. It finished up like that. And it says, astrobiology gets you down to the deep world's deepest hydrothermal vent and black smoker at 4,960 meters, which was wrong. We later found it was 4,980 meters. And as we say in the movies,